Hello, everybody. Welcome to 2020 and Crew Call Volume 2, Number 1. That means year 2, first month, for anybody that worries about things like that. And I am joined this time by not only one, but two people on the podcast, Jim Lincoln and Randy Hamill. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
This is a kind of an experiment because in the entire history of Mike and Scotty Live and now Crew Call, it's always been a two-person thing. But since we're recording with Zoom, it just seems like all things are possible. And I'm optimistic that the three-person format will be just fine.
Excellent.
So, Jim, to start with you first, I want people to know who you are and that we can maybe talk a little bit about how we initially met. I think it was at the Craftsman Structure Show, if I'm not mistaken.
I do believe so, yeah. I want to say it was 2011, maybe.
Wow.
It could be earlier than that, but it's a long time ago.
Time
but,
flies.
Yeah, we met at the Craftsman.
Time flies when you're having fun. You know, I was talking with my wife last night and I, you know, there was some movie that we were looking at, or some TV show, and it was from 2000. And I said, do you realize the year 2000 was 20 years ago? And then it took us a little while to kind of parse that, you know, because that was always supposed to be the future, you know?
Yep.
So when I was thinking about how we originally ran into each other, I think I had a table there, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm trying to figure out how you got wind of the fact that I was trying to get a crossing made. Was that like how would you, had I talked about it on the big podcast that we all used to be on?
I don't remember. I just.
I mean, how else could it have been, right?
It could have been that. You could have been in the course of conversation. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I had said, well, you know, I could hand lay all of it for you. And you were like, oh, okay, yeah, right. Moving on.
You know, and I distinctly remember me thinking, yeah, right. And then it was a two-day event. And I think you came back the next day and you showed me an example of your work. And that's when I thought, wait a minute.
I think we've
got a live one here.
even then, you were kind of like, as you told it later, you were like, I can't believe anybody would do that.
Well, right. There is that aspect of it.
So, but, you know, why would he come and do that? Yeah.
But it ended up, Jim ended up coming down and spending, was it like one evening a week or was it more than one? I think it was just one, right?
It was generally one. There may have been a couple of, like, on one hand count.
Yeah.
Twice in a week, but I don't think so.
But over
I think it was just the Monday nights.
Yeah, and then, of course, you would often do some stuff at your workbench.
Right.
But you know, the primary thing that Jim built for me was an amazing 30-degree curved crossing that I needed to access a particular siding at Mehoopany, something utterly unavailable commercially. And it's just a work of art. The thing works perfectly and has always worked perfectly. And it's definitely a one of a kind. So it's just a very cool thing to have on your layout. And I think at the time you also introduced me to frog juicers, which I've been using all over the place now. There's another product that just works and works perfectly. But you ended up, as you were working on that, you said, you know, I could make this turn out or I could make these turn out. Next thing you know, you're building basically 95% of the turnouts at Mehoopany. Including now,
as I recall, the way the conversation went was, because I remember this conversation, because he's like, well, you could do this. And I said, well, yes, I can do that. But then I have to hand lay, for it to look right, I have to hand lay the turnouts going into it.
Right.
And then when I hand lay those, you really need, because you had the Pico turnouts laid out.
Right, right.
And I was like, Mike, that just looks dumb. And you can either lay them all or build your you know, build your Mahoopany differently.
Right.
But the benchwork was there. So it basically, you either hand lay the everything or it's going to look stupid.
Well, it was a classic slippery slope, you know, and
yes.
there were a few things that needed to be invented as we went along, like
yep.
how are we going to do the throw bars and how are we going to yep. keep them in place, and enter Randy Hamill, who I think of as the Z-scale throw bar guy, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Randy, if I'm not mistaken, I probably met you first at a New England proto meet, and I think your place is like within walking distance of the original meet location, right?
Yeah, I'm a half mile from it, so I would walk there and frequently bring people over to look at projects and the layout and that sort of thing.
Right, and I think Jim and I walked there that day, and we ended mm-hmm. up having a nice conversation. So, you know, it's funny how, you know, you get to meet people at an event like that, and you just never know where it's going to go from there, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's that's one of the things that I love the most about the hobby is the people and, you know, the various places we get to together with people, whether it's the prototype meets or operations at various layouts and that sort of thing.
Right. So before we get to your background, which I know is going to be interesting, let's just finish up a little bit with Jim, because, you know, he's got a very eclectic kind of a modeling background as well. Just as a
point of reference to the Z-scale throw bar thing,
yeah,
I'm still using them.
Oh, I still have a couple here myself.
Well, no, I mean when I lay my Proto 48 switches, that's what I use. I use Z-scale.
Wow, so it looks like a rod in that scale.
Correct. It looks amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think of you, Jim, as if the project doesn't have a sufficient degree of difficulty, you're just not that interested in it.
Track-wise, you probably.
Yeah. Like. You like a challenge, but you're also a little confused about what your focus should be until recently, right? Because you were HO, you were N, right? And settled in, I think, on Proto 48, and I think that one's got legs, right? That's pretty much where you settled?
Yeah. Like a lot of people, you can look at a lot of scales and you can see the benefits of all of them. I think I'm more useful, shall we say, to Proto 48 than
they need you more.
They need me more than like a lot of mm-hmm. other things. It's like, you know, HO scale, whatever. They got Randy. but you know, Proto 48, there's like four of us that are interested in producing anything for the modern Proto 48 modeler. So that may be a little excessive.
So you're a big fish in an extremely small pond, right?
Apparently. Yeah. So yeah, my goal was is when I entered Proto 48, I looked at it and I said, this is infinitely more complicated than it should be. You know, this is so cool, but the perception of it, and it's a fairly reasonable reality, is that you need to have a machine shop to do it. And
are you speaking strictly of track or everything else to do with it?
Track's easy enough, because handling track in Proto 48, while it's more time-consuming, it's actually easier in a lot of ways than HO scale.
Parts are bigger.
There's a lot less. Well, the parts are bigger. There's no filing, really. You don't have to file anything.
There's no filing? How is that possible?
Because you're using parts. So you get the switch point.
Oh, you're not making all this stuff. I got
no.
you.
Mm-hmm. I do for the switches on my little switching thing that I'm doing right now. However, I don't need to do that. I could buy commercial points and use those. There's a little bit of filing to get those to fit properly.
Sure.
But there isn't the gargantuan amount of work of filing points and filing frogs and, you know, welding them together and all that other stuff. So
why is it that those parts are available in Proto 48, but not in HO? That almost doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you can kind of do it in HO, but the difference is that in Proto 48, you can actually get the wheel sets that have the prototype flanges and the wheel profile. So you have to have that.
This isn't like Code 88 in HO. This is full scale.
It'd be like Proto 87, and Proto 87 stores does have frogs and points available in HO that you could purchase commercially. And the Central Valley Model Works also has their versions of points and frogs in their kits as well.
So, Randy, is that what basically you were using to do all of your stuff? I know I'm jumping around here, but it probably is pertinent.
Yeah, I mean, you actually have two guys that are really interested in modeling track right now, so we could spend a lot of time on this. I tried the Proto 48 and the Central Valley Model Works points, and I didn't really like either of them as much as just making my own from that standpoint. But I did try both of their products. The Proto 87 ones, actually, I think I used on a lot of turnouts when I hand laid them. I didn't like their throw bar system, which is why I ended up eventually doing the Z-scale PC board ties.
Throw bars are always the weak link, you know, and are you using hand throws with your Z-scale throw bars, or are you motorized? Like, what are you using for that?
Now I ended up basically going all with microengineering turnouts, and then I'm adding the extra throw bar with the Z-scale throw bar for the scenic aspect of it.
Okay.
My original intention was to use a manual hand throw using caboose ground throws on the fascia.
Yeah.
But the biggest challenge I was using Proto 87 stores has this very small inner diameter tubing. It's flexible tubing, so the wire can't flex inside the tube.
Right.
And so that worked really well. You could put it around corners or, you know, whatever you needed to do to get it in the right location. But what I found is that you really had to be pretty precise with the methodology, you know, soldering it to the throw bar, as well as where it attaches to the ground throw. And I wasn't that consistently good at something that precise.
Oh boy.
So then the two of you guys were coming up with the idea of the switch underneath the throw bar. Isn't that how you ended up doing the ones in your layout?
Yeah, that's how all of Mahopani is, and it tends to work just fine unless I have like an expansion kink or a solder joint lets go, and then the tension on the points lets me know that, whoops, I have to fix something because the switch is no longer holding it.
Yeah. So because I was looking at it, either trying to do that manual thing, because I couldn't afford to do tortoises. I've got, I think, 101 turnouts on my layout now. So then I was looking to see how I could, you know, do some sort of spring action on it, but nothing I saw really looked good. I mean, it was all kind of defeating the purpose of trying to do track that was as realistic looking as possible to stick a wire spring on top of it. So I ended up going to microengineering, and then I'm making them look a little better by thinning the initial throw bar that's on there. You can actually make it a little thinner because it's just plastic, and then adding the Z-scale throw bar and some other details to get the same effect, but take advantage of the spring that they've got built into their turnouts and stuff.
Well, if you get a chance, I'd love to see a picture of that. Maybe you can upload it to the group.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
So Jim, getting back to you now, you have been building your Proto 48 layout for quite a while now, right? More than 2 or 3 years, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fits and starts. Just, you know, I'll work on a little bit and then stop and work on it a little bit and stop.
And so, it's a switching layout, would you say?
Mostly. It's actually kind of a copy of Jim Cantor's round. It's essentially a 4x8 layout, but in O scale. And when I say a 4x8 layout, take a 4x8 sheet of plywood and double it, and it's that. Because O scale is, you know, nominally double the size of
it's an
in all directions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
Right. So it's It's about 8x16, but it's not quite that. But that's the original. And the plan is really cool because it allows you to run three trains at a time. One goes around and round in circles constantly, if you want to. One can do the switching of the industries on the inside loop. And then you have an outside loop where you could do a shuttle circuit. So like I have an RDC that's converted to Proto 48. So I was thinking of having that as a, you know, like a commuter service that goes back and forth from staging to staging.
Do you think you're the only person on the planet with a Proto 48 RDC?
No. No. There has to be at least two of us.
Just seems a tad fringe, but I love it. So is all of your track work completely in now, would you say?
Oh, no. One of the things holding me back at the moment is that I'm building my bench work with Gator Home, totally. And it's kind of pricey.
What thickness?
Half inch.
Oh, half inch. Okay. I'm only familiar with the quarter inch, but yeah, I bet that half inch stuff is
It's
great.
It's
but where do you source it?
I want to say it's not A-Line, it's U-Line. Is it U-Line?
Oh, U-Line, yeah.
I think you can buy a carton of three, but it's $100 a sheet.
Wow.
I'm even using it for roadbed. So, because it's dimensionally stable, it's very easy to spike into. And when I say that, it's not that home and soda is not easy to spike into, but it doesn't compress at all.
Yes, it's a lot better quality and a lot more uniform than home and soda could ever be.
Correct. Yeah. I've laid track on home and soda. So if you do home and soda spine or spline, it's great. But you're using a lot of home and soda, you're creating a lot of dust and, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, no. So
just to be clear, your bench work is not made of this, right?
My bench work is made of that, yeah.
Bench work is made of this. So the whole thing is, wow.
The whole thing is Gator Foam.
So you got a couple of bucks in bench work there.
Well, not yet, because I have not built it all. because it's expensive. So I have a corner module, and I have a 8 foot straight module. So it's 30 inches. It's 30 inches by 8 feet. And then the corner modules are nominally 4x4.
How has the Gator board responded to humidity changes?
There is no response to humidity changes.
Just doesn't
Zero.
Budge.
Just doesn't move. No. Hmm. No, that, yeah, it's totally doesn't move at all. I mean, it's really easy to work with. You just glue it together.
When I've used it in the past, in fact, a lot of the Mahoopany plant is made out of that, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I could just, cut it in the workshop on the table saw, if I had big
pieces. Yep, that's what I did.
Yeah, it just worked. Yeah, then it was very easy to get an accurate cut and very nice to work with.
So what I do is on a table saw, I cut them into structure, just 1x3, not 1x3s, but
yeah.
They're about 4 inches, about 3.5, 4 inches. So about like a 1x4, but not obviously. And that's the right size for O scale roadbed too.
I see.
So you can, what you do, I mean, you probably can figure this out, but you make cuts on either side about, two thirds of the way through.
Like the old homo bed used to be.
Correct. Yeah. And then you can bend it around corners.
So what are you bonding it with?
Various things. There's one, it's downstairs. It's like phenol sealed caulk it's not what it's called, but it's,
the DAP stuff. Like we put track down with.
It's similar to that, but it's specifically the thing that the guy at Springfield who sells Gator Board, he sells all sorts of Gator Board there, that's what he uses to put it together. Now, I've also used, it is Loctite, their universal construction adhesive.
Okay.
I've used that too. That's good for foam in general. So you can put, pink foam together with it, doesn't attack it.
Mm-hmm.
And it locks real quick. It'll hold it together right away. Kinda. You know, as long as it's not really moving, there's no tension on it, it's not going to go anywhere. You start trying to pull it apart, it'll come apart.
There's so many bonding agents now available compared to when, I started out. And last year I had attended a Journal of Light Construction show in Providence. And it's all tool and materials vendors that are geared towards the construction market. And they, the DAP people were there, and you could sign up and they'd send you supposedly a free case of this new stuff that they were pushing. And I had forgotten all about it. And like 2.5 or 3 months later, this case of this DAP new construction adhesive showed up, 12 tubes of it. And the stuff is like $6 or $7 a tube. So I was happy to get it. And it's what I've been using to attach all of my fascia. And it, mm-hmm. It's easy to work with. It almost has a pretty quick tack to it, but you've got about 15 minutes of working time, so you don't have to sweat it so much. And mm-hmm. And I've been using it for some other things too. Foam to foam, it works great on. It's got almost a little bit of flexibility to it. And again, that ability to tack immediately, but, reposition easily. So I don't know. I've become a big fan of it. But anyway, I meant to ask you, the sizes of this Gator foam board that you're buying, what sheet size are you using?
See, what I want to, one of the things that's holding is I could buy like small pieces because I could go buy, 2x4 sheets.
Right.
From the guy at Springfield. And that's not that much money. It's not as much of a hit all at once. I really need 4x8 sheets. And you say, why do you need 4x8 sheets? Because when you build an 8-foot module, even though it's made out of Gator foam, and I brace the snot out of it, it's still bowed a little in the middle. So
be better because if it was one thing, wouldn't it?
It's one, yeah, it would be better than it was one thing. So what I have is a 4-foot piece, butt jointed together with another 4-foot piece on the inside of it.
Yep.
Connecting the two.
Sure.
But even that, there's a little bit of a bow. And where I'm fairly certain that if it's one piece, it's not going to do that. So
have you considered talking to a sign shop or your local glass supplier or somebody like that? Because that's who I'm sourcing my 4x8 sheets of styrene from. Locally,
I have considered it a lot of times. The couple of places that they used to sell them by single sheets, and now you have to buy like
a bundle.
Five. Yeah, you have to buy a bundle. And Uline is at least as good because you can just buy three.
Sure.
Some places they want you to buy a dozen.
The shipping must kill you.
I haven't checked it yet because it's, although I could probably use three sheets, I'm at the point of, do I really want to spend that money?
Right.
So right, all at once. What I had thought of was try to find a bunch of people that would like to use it and get a bunch of 12, because then it drops the sheet price, and then see if you could sell the sheets. But I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to do that.
So Randy, as a fellow wooden layout construction person, tell us a little bit about your layout.
It is wood. I actually built it out of OSB because that's the opposite end of the spectrum. It's really cheap.
Wow.
It's less than $10 a sheet. And I figured if they could build my house using it, it would work just fine to build a layout.
So did you use that for the dimensional lumber also? You ripped it?
No, well, I this is actually the third layout I've built in the basement. And the second one I built, I did all the dimensional stuff with OSB. But when I started building this one, I found that if I looked at the furring strips at Home Depot, and they were actually really good shape, I could get them pretty cheap enough that it didn't make any sense to go and rip it, because I don't own a table saw. So when I built the layout before, I spent the day at a friend's house,
yep,
ripping OSB and also ripping Masonite into 3/4-inch spline.
Is this the layout that I've seen, the one that you have now?
No, that was the one prior to that. I have some pictures, but it was, I completed the bench work and I had the main line operating. I actually built the entire bench work and main line in less than a month. And using the OSB and the Masonite, it cost me less than $40 for all the bench work.
Jeez.
It was a super inexpensive way to do it. But once I started building the one of New Britain, I knew everything was going to be flat, so it didn't make any sense to use spline at that point. I could just use, you know, full sheets. And since I was using full sheets, I was just building a basic framework out of 1x3 and 1x2 furring strips to do that. And then I use primarily either 1x2 or 2x2 legs, depending on where I need it. So.
Yep. All my layout legs are 2x2s that were under the construction material bundles from building the addition. I saved every one of them. And believe it or not, nice. I used every single one that I saved. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, I'm sure. Yep.
What are you modeling specifically?
So it's New Britain, Connecticut, on the New Haven Railroad, and I've been blogging about it, but I realized for like 12 years now at newbritainstation.com.
You have a particular era?
Yeah, 46 to 54, because the infrastructure didn't really change much in that time period. So I can swap out a few structures and details. And the big thing is swapping out the motive power and stuff, because the New Haven cycled through equipment very rapidly in that time period. They were moving steam off, and they fully dieselized by 52, if I recall.
But you like to have
so
a mix,
every
right?
year. Yeah. Every year is a different set of motive power, because it goes from all steam. Well, actually you have to go back to 45 to all steam. And then in New Britain, steam was off of the layout by the end of 48. So from that time period, you start going through the first and second generation of diesels. The RS1s come and go, the RS2s come and go, and then you end up with all RS3s and RDCs by 54. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, the RS3 had a good long life, didn't it?
Yep. So, and on the New Haven, they were used all over the place.
And Jim, not to leave you out of the era question, but I'm not even sure if I know, actually. Are you like a 90s modeler, would you say?
Yeah, I'd say in the 90s, maybe 2000s, but it's kind of floating.
Right.
Because it's a freelance layout, so.
But some of the industries are based on your, I should probably point out, you were a CSX conductor for a few years, right?
Yeah, about 4 years, yep.
Yeah, and so a lot of your prototype bent, I think, is based on your actual experiences walking around on the track, looking at prototype industries and things like that, would you say?
Yeah, you know, obviously one of the industries that are going to be on this layout is a corn syrup plant, obviously, because I have a lot of corn syrup cars. I like corn syrup cars, so... I actually kind of have a thing for tank cars in general, but...
And there are some good ones available in your scale.
Yes. Atlas makes some excellent ones. Believe it or not, Lionel makes some excellent cars. Just
really?
Figuring out how to... Yeah. When Lionel does scale stuff, it's beautiful. It really is.
Maybe it comes out of the same factory.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, there's going to be that. There's probably going to be some place for sand, you know, some construction thing. I might want to go take a look at your grain elevators and see if there's an interesting one to build an O-scale.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always had a thing for grain elevators, and I have lots of pictures. So even if you don't see something here, I've got a lot of pictures to share, because every time I was out rail fanning, I'd look at something and go, ooh, that would be good to model. A lot of that goes from your era, you know what I mean, before I backdated into the earlier 80s when I was out all the time rail fanning.
Well, I'm kind of in the BNSF era, but,
yeah,
you know, a little. Do you have anything from, like, California? Like, grain elevators from California?
Absolutely.
Okay. Might want to take a look at some of those. So,
okay. Is your locale West Coast, basically?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So that's sort of the background of you guys. But, like, how do you guys know one another?
Same way that you and I met. You and Jim both came over to look at the track work.
Okay.
Yeah. At that particular meet when we went over to his house.
Yep. And speaking of proto meets, you were both just down at Cocoa Beach, right?
Yes,
correct.
And I understand it was the usual well-attended, highly successful event that it's always been?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
20th year.
Wow.
You missed the cake, Mike.
Oh, I missed the cake?
Yeah.
I missed the cake.
I think I had perfect attendance for the first dozen years or so, but, you know, I just kind of got worn out.
Yeah, this was my first time making it down there.
Was it really?
Yeah.
So how did it hit you as a first time attendee?
I really enjoyed it. It was, I actually made it out to the Lyle, the Chicagoland one, for the first time this year too, and they've both been really high on my list.
Sure.
And it's interesting how unique each one is. They're quite different from the New England prototype meet.
Every meet has its own personality. I agree.
Yeah. Yep. They really do. And there was a little bit of overlap in people there, but not a huge amount. So it was kind of neat to see a bunch of people that I especially know online and stuff like that, but had never gotten to meet face to face.
That's one of the big benefits of it. I agree, because Cocoa is probably the East Coast meet that gets the most West Coast people, possibly based in part on the time of year and what have you. But
sure.
The one meet that has eluded me, and I hate to say it, probably always will, because I've kind of like run out of wanderlust, but the St. Louis meet has an excellent reputation, and it's a great bunch of guys that go there and love the pictures from it. But you know, it's St. Louis. It's usually in August, I think, or something like that, or September, like a really hot part of the year. And having been to St. Louis before in the summer, I love St. Louis in the fall.
I have to tell you, Mike, you've got to go.
Everybody says
I've been, I've been once, and I wish I could go all the time. I went once. Now, driving there was my – okay, so
– You drove there. My God.
I drove there. And I split it up over 3 days.
Yeah.
So I drove to Altoona.
Okay.
And slept. I drove to Indianapolis and slept. I then was 2 hours out of Indianapolis when I said to myself, you know – this is as far across this country as I ever want to drive. And I still had 2 hours to go.
Well, I remember the time Scott and I went to what's the Chicago meet, the little city it's in?
Lyle.
Well,
it used to be Naperville.
Naperville is what it was at that time, but yes, Lyle. Yeah. So we drove out, just the two of us, nonstop, and all we did was we just switched off every tank of gas, and it was 16 hours straight. And I don't care who you are, after about 10 hours, you're not talking about much.
Yep.
Even Scott, who's never been at a loss for words, but we both agreed that on the way back we were you know, grabbing a hotel halfway, because that just comes right out of your hide.
Oh yeah. Yeah, my wife and I did a trip back from Rochester, Minnesota, for it was a 24-hour drive. So yeah,
oh,
been there, done that.
My son, who is admittedly much younger, but he drives, from Naples, Florida, so tip of Florida, back home here in southeastern Mass. And he does that in two stretches. So
yep.
That's something for the 35-year-olds, not me.
Yeah. We make Myrtle Beach a 2-day trip now. So
yep. So while you guys were down there, you started chatting it up about a new venture that Randy's involved in, and I think I want to hear all about that. I deliberately didn't want to hear too much in advance of this show, so that it could be fresh. And you should include a little bit about your background and your association with some manufacturing. So the floor is yours, Randy. Let's hear about your new concept here.
Sure. Well, this is something I started thinking about. I worked with TrueLine Trains for about a decade, I guess. It's amazing how fast it goes by, as well as working on projects for some other companies and stuff like that, too. But most of the work I did was with TrueLine.
In what capacity, Randy?
Kind of everything, really. Darren owns it, but I was, it was the two of us for basically the bulk of that time. So, working on whatever projects and whatever needed to be done. I came on initially to build the web page for him. But I just wanted to be in the industry. So it was something that was more for fun than anything else. It's essentially a one man show because Darren owns it. His father owned the business before when it was Lifelike of Canada, and Hobbycraft Canada. And they were in a lot of different, they were, the largest distributor in Canada for hobby supplies. They owned their own, type of modeling clay that was huge in Canada, as well as things like plastic models and slot cars and everything. So they were kind of everything. But by the time I got there, it was pretty much just Darren and a handful of employees that he had. It's just a tough industry is really what it comes down to. And because of a number of things, but all related to cash flow, basically, it's been a challenge. And I'm not sure when Darren's going to be able to do anything with TrueLine at this point. But I also had a lot of projects that I wanted to do that, because he was focusing on Canadian prototypes, they weren't necessarily going to be something that was going to get done really soon.
Right.
So I wanted to do something on my own. So I worked on some ideas for a few years, and then it was actually, again, at the prototype meet this last year, I met a guy named John Drake, who's a real neat guy. He has modeled an N scale. He's now going back to HO scale. He had also worked briefly for the Union Pacific before going into, I think it was in reinsurance and stuff was his main thing. So he was trying to model N scale when he was living in Grand Cayman, which talk about a place that's hard to get anything for modeling.
Yeah, those UPS deliveries aren't so easy yet, are they?
Nope. It sounds like it was very interesting trying to do that. But that was kind of the catalyst to get me moving, because it's really easy to look at a new project at this scale and say this is going to be a huge success when you don't actually have to do anything.
Right, with no skin in the game.
But, as soon as you, start trying to do it, it's all different, and you see if it's going to work. So
I know a little bit about that, because back in the day, I had an idea for we're talking about the 90s again, right? I had three different freight cars that I wanted to get produced. And, not knowing anything, I went down and ended up having a meeting and a really nice long chat with Lee English at Bowser. And he was a good
guy.
He was a good guy to talk to, because like your friend Darren there, his company does a lot of everything, and he's been around the block. So he basically explained all of the issues and what would be involved. And by the time I left there, I was pretty sure there was no way I was going to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, it's a challenge, and that was the big thing. Is I have access to the factories, the same factory that's done projects for us, for, you know, at TrueLine, as well as for other companies. So all of that aspect of it was lined up and ready to go, and I have a big list of cars that I want to do. So it was a matter of John and I figuring out what we wanted to start with. But the basic concept of the whole business, which we've called Prototype Junction, is that we want to look at more niche products, things that other companies typically wouldn't do because it would be challenging to do them injection molded because they just don't know if they'd be able to recoup their costs.
Sure.
And also taking it from the approach that Sunshine Models did, where you would look at a particular design and Martin would do kind of all the variations of that given prototype. And so each year he would go to the, because he ran the Naperville show, he'd come with whatever that year's models would be. And it was usually a couple of prototypes and all the variations of those prototypes.
Nick Molo is actually doing a little bit of that, I think. You know, he's offering all these different variations and concentrating on a very high quality offering.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So the with the manufacturing side of things, with the factory in place and everything, the only thing that was consistently and is really still the problem the TrueLine has now is the cash flow. So one of the other things that I'm usually heavily involved in is role-playing gaming hobby, and they have done an enormous amount of crowdfunding things through Kickstarter primarily. Also at Indiegogo, and it's been really interesting because there's lots of, like this hobby, lots of creative people who have great ideas and they have a product or something that they think would be good, whether it's a book or a game or miniatures or, you know, all sorts of different things. And rather than having to fund it all themselves, the crowdsourcing lets them, number one, split it up among all the people that want to see that project get finished. But more importantly, it means that everybody has a much lower amount of money that they need to put up for the project to be viable. And so that's the approach that we've decided to take with this.
Now, can I stop you for a sec there? Why is there a lower amount of money needed?
Not a lower amount of money needed to make the project happen. But if you're spreading it out about, across 2,000 people funding it, it's a low amount per person.
I see. So it becomes, in a sense, a cooperative venture of sorts.
Exactly. And I really see it as an extension of that sort of community of modelers that we see at the prototype meets.
Yep.
You know, any manufacturer will tell you, everybody, you're at a meet, whether it's the Springfield show or the prototype meet, and it's just lots of people coming up, hey, you guys should make this car, you guys should do this car, you know, that's the sort of thing that's always the case. And the answer is always like, okay, go find enough people that want it and we can look at it as a project.
Yeah, they always tell
so
me
rather than
how about the pictures, bring me a bunch of pictures.
Yep. Yep, pictures. Yeah, well, so any, you know, information is always a key thing, right? Drawings, pictures, all that sort of stuff so that you can actually produce the model. But ultimately, you've got to be able to sell the model.
And the problem with that, forgive me for, you know, mm-hmm. jumping in, is people will come and say, well, I'll buy one.
Yep, yep. No, no, okay. I got people say they'll buy 20.
Or, you know, right, I'll buy 20. Okay.
Yeah.
But the factory expects me to buy 2,000.
Exactly.
And so 20 doesn't really help unless you get 1,000 of your friends to buy them too.
So people always wonder about these quantities that get bandied about, you know. Would you say that is 2,000 units the minimum critical mass?
For
make a project
a normal,
viable if it's injection
yeah,
mold.
Yeah, normal injection molded, I would say that most companies would shoot for 2,500 to 3,000 units.
Okay.
If it's a rerun of a project, then you can get away with 1,000 or 2,000 units because the tooling's all paid for, presumably,
sure.
and already present.
Yep.
But that's ultimately the issue with the project is that normally what a company would do is they put together a project, they know what the cost is, and they pay everything up front. So you're paying for the tooling, you're paying for the production and all of that, and then you ship it to the dealers or the customers, and then you get paid. So, right. You know, it's a very front-loaded process for a manufacturer to go through.
Sure.
And, you know, it's every project's a little different, but you're not only paying for the cost of the tooling, but then you have to pay for the production itself. So you typically have a per unit cost. And then you've got to pay for packaging, shipping from the factory, which at this point, obviously, is almost always in China. And then, you know, whatever
other
expenses.
Is that where the tooling is done also, Randy? In other words, are you basically sending CAD drawings, or like how does that work?
It depends on the company. Everybody's a little different. So
I'm
I know there's
about
some companies,
in your proposed instance.
Yeah. In my case, yes, because I don't have the equipment or the expertise to do my own tooling.
Right.
So we would have the factory is going to do the whole project for us. And they've done that for companies before. So I don't have any issue with that. But it does have an impact on the price. So, you know, some companies that can do their own, they have the expertise and the equipment in-house, can save money on that aspect of a project, whereas I've got to pay somebody to do it.
But it stands to reason that no small company has that in-house, right?
Well, Accurail, I'm pretty sure, does all of their own stuff in-house, because I think that's what Dennis Dorsett does. I think he's a tool and die maker, from what I understand.
Right.
So that's an example of a small company that can do it because Don Tichy, for example, he's, you know, in the industry, and my understanding is that trains is sort of a hobby. He does jobs for other people in other industries, and then uses the available time and that he has when he's not making stuff for other people to run stuff for the train hobby. So,
got it.
So if you're somebody like Don Tichy, you can afford to do that and make all those doors and windows and detail parts and do it inexpensively.
You know what? That company is such a resource. I don't know where we would be without
them.
Yep,
absolutely. So, and that's a perfect example of somebody who can take their normal business and turn it into, you know, a side business doing something they love as a hobby, which is
sure.
Kind of neat. But in our case, we're going to have the factory do all of that, but we've got the full quote, and we know pretty much exactly what it's going to cost to do the project as a whole. So from start to finish, including the production. And it kind of addresses another issue that I've routinely had with my own modeling, is that a lot of times a company will release a model. The first run, in theory, is going to pay for all of your tooling. And then the second run, you maybe add a couple of other variations and then you start to make some profit off of it.
Sure.
But there's so many models that I'm waiting for that never got to the second run because the first model, you know, run wasn't sufficient to warrant it. And so without those sales, there's product that should exist, but doesn't because they weren't able to make that happen.
Right.
So
how do you avoid that in this case?
Well, we just make it all part of one project. So because we're not as concerned about making it really a viable business. Like we're not expecting this project to pay for part of the next project and so on to keep the business running. It's sort of a standalone entity that pays for itself. So the entire project ends up being $250,000 project. But we have 17 different prototypes that we're doing in the project at one time. So they'll all be available about a year is what it usually takes to produce the injection molded products. And all of those variations will be available at that one time. And we don't have to worry about trying to do a second run. If there's enough call, we could certainly do that, but we'd rather look at doing additional products and new models instead of rerunning what we did the first year.
Well, if I take $250,000 and I divide it by say $40, I come up with over 6,000 that would need to be sold.
Yep. About 6,000 units.
Yep. Does that mean that if something is only viable for, say, 2,500 or 3,000, it has to cost twice that?
No, well, so because we're doing so many different prototypes, it's kind of doing multiple projects at once. So none of these, the core of the project is the Santa Fe BX11, BX12, and BX13 boxcars.
Yeah.
They're single sheath boxcars. And the Santa Fe had several thousand of them, but it's a one road car. The most interesting version of it was in the early 40s, they started rebuilding a bunch of them with raised roofs. So they did an 8-inch, but the 12-inch one is just very noticeable because the car side looks the same. They didn't change that. And then they just have a steel extension on top of that to raise the roof with an extra panel on the end. So it's instantly recognizable, even from an oblique angle in a picture, you can spot them because they don't look like anything else.
Yep, and my guess is this would be a car that would look great on your layout.
It would look great on my layout, but they ran into the 70s.
Really?
Yeah, they were built in 1929 to 1931, but some ran as late as the 70s. And then in the 1950s, they also started rebuilding them with steel sides, and those also ran into the 70s. So there's 10 variations of the Santa Fe cars alone, because you've got the three original variations. Then the BX 11 and 12 both received both either the 8-inch or the 12-inch roof. The BX 13s and then eventually the 12s and 11s also got rebuilt with steel sides. So you've got 10 different variations with those. But if you were going to do one project and only one group of cars, you could do just the single sheath cars and the raised roof versions. That's probably about 80% of the tooling cost for this project.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether those cars alone would be worth 3,000 units.
Sure.
And I don't think they would. I mean, I think they would be very popular, but it's a tough call. And if somebody else was footing the cost for this out of, you know, their pocket or the company paying for it up front, it just seems like a version that people would not likely see in injection molded plastic. But taking those two, that's two of the cores, because the single sheath car is a different body than the steel sided car, obviously, because the sides have to be different.
Mm-hmm.
We're designing them a lot like the branch line models. So the ends and the roofs are separate, which means they'll be available as parts as well.
That was
but
my
they were
next
similar
question.
Cars. Yeah, well, and then, so that's actually, I'll actually get into that in a moment, because there's some other, you know, I don't know, kind of philosophy, I guess, of modeling that I've got that I want to incorporate into this and that John and I are both real excited about. So in addition to those cars, there were a number of roads that took what was essentially a standard boxcar design. So in the early 20s, the ARA had this single sheath boxcar design, the XM1 standard that not too many roads built. They were mostly in the southeast and east. Boston and Maine had them, BAR had them, Seaboard, that sort of thing. But Santa Fe was one of them that built that took the same basic design but made them larger. They're taller and they're wider than the original cars. A number of roads made 40-foot double-door auto cars with larger designs as well. And so we're doing those. There's CGW, L&N, and Per Marquette all had those cars. And then the PM cars also became part of C&O and were lettered for them.
Well, sounds like you're well along on the planning process here. How many models ahead would you say you're already planning?
Well, it's all going to be built entirely to order. So the specifics per prototype will be based entirely on the orders. But because of the size of the project, we have to do less than 400 units per prototype on average, which is a far cry from the 2,000, 3,000, unit range.
Sounds like a lot of thought went into how to make it economically possible.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's been a big part of this, is trying to figure out how to make the project work, but also to hit those kind of key points. Number one, giving a lot of options for people, because if it was the one prototype or one group, I think getting all of that, you know, the orders is going to be a tough project. With 17 different prototypes to choose from, that ran from 1929 to the 70s. And I think some of the steel side Santa Fe cars might have even lasted till the early 80s. It really hits a lot of different eras that people can cover with them and need multiple cars. It's not just like, oh, well, this is the same car as that one in just a different paint scheme. We're looking hopefully for people to buy 2, 3, or 4 cars. And most of the orders we're getting so far are for multiple cars, I think just for that reason.
So in other words, this is not something that is in the concept stage. This is something you guys are actively doing, because you're talking about orders that you're getting.
Yeah, no, we launched it at Cocoa Beach.
I see.
Where we announced it. Yep, and we've gotten, it's not a huge number of orders yet. We got a long way to go, but we'll see 20,000 people at Springfield this weekend.
Sure.
So that's the whole, our whole launch process was, let's do almost like a soft launch at Cocoa Beach, because that's 250 people or so.
Yep.
You know, we've been out on forums, and, you know, we've got our webpage and stuff like that. But Springfield is a place where a lot of companies launch their products. It's such a huge show.
Right.
It's a great way to get the word out there. So the project itself is really ready to go. We've already got the quote from the factory and all. It's just a matter of raising the money.
Now, I'm a project manager, as some folks know, and mm-hmm. I'm listening to your model here, and mm-hmm. it sounds a little daunting to manage the process of it, just from a, you know, it sounds like, you know, you've got all these, you're going to have all these individual orders from people rather than just bringing in droves of similar items. Do I have it wrong?
No, I mean, that's the process itself. Like, when the factory builds models, they'll take all of the stuff that they're, you know, producing, and they'll desprue everything. So they've got little, you know, containers of parts. And then it's a matter of, you know, somebody sits there with, say, body core number one, and they're going to assemble however many products they have to do with that. And it'll say, okay, so for today, you're assembling 37 cars or 370 cars or 3,700 cars. It doesn't really matter, using ends number one and roof number one, and, you know, all the other parts are similar. And then after they've finished that part of the order, they just move on to the next one. And it's actually not too different from the process that they use for brass models. If you look at Precision Scale, they'll sometimes bring in 4 or 5 of one variation of locomotive that has very specific details on it. And that's all that was made in that particular run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as a project as a whole, they've got a dozen different prototypes, and they might have 10 or 12 of one, 4 of another, and 100 of something that was more common. So it's not something that's unheard of in the industry, but I guess you could say it's a little bit more risky if you have to fund it yourself, because you're talking about kind of rolling 2 or 3 projects in under the umbrella of one project, in terms of when you have to pay for it and the production and all that sort of stuff.
What do you think the lead time is for people to go from, you know, sending in their money to getting their product?
So typically in injection molding, and we're saying it's going to be about a year, because that's the usual approach. At Trueline, when we did the mini box, that one, from the time we made the first payment to the factory to delivery, was less than 8 months. So it can be pretty quick, if you're ready to go. And again, to me, the biggest thing, and this is my experience, other people in the industry may have had different experiences, but in my experience, it seemed to be always held up by cash flow. Factory's ready for the next step. We don't have the cash to pay them, so we got to wait. And maybe they go on and do another project in that time. So now that you've got
you've got to wait till they're available. Right.
That sort of thing. So having it fully funded before we actually start moving forward, I think is going to be the biggest factor.
Yep.
In terms of the logistics of getting the models produced. But the bigger thing for us is not so much this project and getting this done. I mean, we looked at a bunch of different potential projects and felt that this one was a good one to start with. Santa Fe obviously is a big seller. The auto cars we're doing have never been done in any form, resin or brass, plastic. They've never been available at all. And so it really, I think it gives enough excitement to get people interested in doing it and jumping on board. But the bigger thing for us is just the possibilities for the future, that if it doesn't really matter how big or small the project is, it's really a question of whether the modelers will support it and say, for example, what Jim and I were talking about was a freight car in Proto 48. Why not? You can put it up there. It's, you know, we can line up and get it ready to go, but then you have the opportunity to say, okay, people are saying they want more freight cars in Proto 48. Time to step up and show us that's what you really mean.
But you still have to commit X amount of resources to a potential project just to be able to get a quote from the factory, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. No, John and I have spent a lot of time getting it ready for this point, and that's kind of the, I don't know, our biggest contribution to this point is to get it all lined up so that we can be ready to do it. And, you know, obviously that's why we went to the Chicagoland show and why I was down in Cocoa Beach, and that all costs money. Not that it's not money I'd want to spend anyway, right? I love going to the shows when I can. But, yeah, I mean, there's the
it's not free.
Even the behind the things. Yeah, no, it's definitely not free because, you know, you're still setting up a business. We've set up an LLC for the usual things. And then the process itself is not free. We're using Indiegogo to fund this, and they take a percentage of it. Of course, the credit card companies get their percentage of it.
Sure.
So there's a lot of different steps. But we also felt that was a much better option, even though it's, you know, our suggested retail price is $50, which is not uncommon for a boxcar today.
Yep.
But we felt that using Indiegogo was a good thing because we don't have access to any of the money unless we fully fund the project. They charge the credit cards, and then if we don't fund it, they refund it automatically. So the money never even, you know, it's just a level of security.
Basically, it's an escrow for all intents and purposes. I see.
Yep, exactly. So, and then once the project's funded, since John and I aren't going to be drawing a paycheck or anything, this isn't, you know, it's almost kind of a hobby for us in a sense, at least for the next year, because we think it's really important that the money that people are pledging is so they can get the models built. It's not to pay us and,
right,
you know, make a business for us. So if we're doing our job right, then we'll have some money left over at the end, but that won't, you know, we won't see any of that until after we've delivered the models to the customers, and that's a big factor. But it's all of that kind of is what I think is what I still see as a big, as more of a community project. It's like, hey, let's get a bunch of people together who want to see the same models and work on it together.
Well, you're going to put so much effort into it, it better be at least partially fun, right?
Yeah, I love the research. I love doing this. I really want to keep making models. And if I can't do that with TrueLine or another company, then I want to do it however I can do it. And, you know, I still do a lot of work with other people when I can. But this is, it's just, like I said, on the looking at other industries, it's been a way to get projects out there that are otherwise probably not going to get done. And I think it would work well for this hobby as well.
The name of the company is?
Prototype Junction. And you can go to prototypejunction.com. That's the easiest place to get to the links to pledge.
And I imagine, I have not been to the website, but I'll be doing that right after this. It just looks all sounds very interesting. Are there any other future projects, projects that are listed on the website, or just what you spoke about tonight?
Just what we're doing right now, because if this doesn't fund, then we're not really able to move forward, and then we'll have to decide what we want to do from there.
Yeah.
We created a Facebook group also called Prototype Junction, specifically to hopefully get people talking about the types of models they want to see. And it's not really just for our benefit. We don't need to do the things that are a big enough project that Intermountain or Tangent or, you know, any of the other companies might pick up and run with. So if there's something that people are really excited about, we're hoping that at least, you know, some of those companies will pick up the word and see that, hey, this is a project that people are looking for. You know, my interest is primarily on stuff I can run on my layout, but there's a lot of people looking for things more modern than that. So whether Intermountain picks up or somebody else says that, hey, this is something that we want to see produced, and how do we do that? We're happy to help people do that as well. And we can hook up people with the factories that we work with. We can help them with the process with Indiegogo, or if they wanted to use Kickstarter or something like that. Because it opens up so many possibilities. And really, one company can't produce all the freight cars that still haven't been made. There's just too many.
Sounds like a creative approach. And probably we're going to see a lot more of this type of thing, you know, moving forward. You've got this manufacturing base. I think you talked about the obstacles, and this is like a creative way of getting around it. So as long as, you know, you can get past the instant gratification problem of waiting mm-hmm. a year for your car, you're going to get what you want, and you wouldn't have gotten it any other way. So I like the idea. Please mm-hmm. do feel free to put a link to your Facebook group on the podcast group so people can find it easily. And if anybody is interested in speaking with you and they happen to be going to the Big E this weekend, where will they find you?
Better Living Center 25G.
Okay, well, bring your hand sanitizer and lots of bottles of water.
Yep.
If you're not croaking by about 1 p.m. on Sunday in an attempt to speak, you haven't done your job.
No, of course not. That's one of the most fun times of the year for me is going to the show and talking to people about what they're modeling. I mean, it's a hobby full of really interesting people.
It is. And I assume also that you'll be doing the same kind of promotion at NERPM in late May, right?
Yeah. Our funding period is 30 days, so we'll be hopefully funded by then. But yes, we will be down at NERPM, as well as I'm hoping we'll make it to spring to the St. Louis show, because I keep hearing great things about that.
What about Valley Forge? Any plans to attend that one?
Yeah, that's on the list as a possibility as well, because even once we're funded, we can still, of course, add to the orders, and people won't actually make their decisions for their final orders until just before we go to production. So, and the whole process is going to be one of constant communication with the backers and, you know, where we stand and looking for their input, because we'll have samples that shows once we get the, you know, we usually do 3D samples to start with. Because we can get those printed from the CAD work before we cut tooling.
Sure.
And then if those look good, then we'll have actual samples that are cast from the tooling. So, you know, we want to make sure that they're done right. And we want, I don't claim to be an expert in every freight car that's out there. I don't think anybody could be. Although there have been a few that are very close. And so it's really something that we want people to be as involved as we can make them. And we're looking at a lot of, I mentioned that we're doing parts because people have been asking for parts a lot. We would do that at Trueline. If people were looking for parts, we just have them run some extra parts while we were doing a project. Same thing with kits. There's really no reason why we can't do decorated or undecorated kits. So, you know, it's since people will be able to tell us exactly what they want, we can find out what they want.
Well, you may know a lot of the same people I know, but if you find yourself doing something a little bit more modern and you'd like to tap into some of my usual suspects, I've got some good ones. We can talk about that offline.
No, yep, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to that because I was thinking, well, you obviously in HO, but also with Jim and the Proto 48 stuff, and a few friends of mine are modeling an S scale. And that's I think it's those smaller areas that are really are really ripe for this type of approach, because there's probably a lot of people that are willing to step up because they're just not getting the product any other way.
Yep, very interesting.
Well, the other thing that comes up is now people can feel involved, whereas, well, I may only buy one model, but I'll help you make it.
Yep.
You know, I only need one, I only need two, but I'll give you a little bit extra money to help it get done. That's a possibility too. This is, Mike, this is the first time anybody's come up to me and said, what about that O scale boxcar? How would you like to do it?
I was going
to
ask you, if you could pick one candidate, what would you pick?
Something simple. It's low hanging fruit, but it's something that hasn't been done at O scale, which is Pullman Standard 5344.
Oh, okay.
You know,
very simple. Common car. Absolutely.
Very common car. You could do single or double door. And it also comes in a lot of interesting paint schemes. See, the wrinkle that I have is that realistically, selling Proto 48 boxcars, you're not going to sell that many. The vast majority of Proto 48 modelers are not modern modelers. Hmm. Now, that may be that because there isn't very much, they're not there. It also may be that they're not very vocal. Don't know.
You've heard the saying, build it and they will come.
Yeah. I believe that my opinion about Proto 48 is that if you did something small and made it available to everybody instead of you needing a machine shop to do it, then people would come. You want to get the people who are getting older, who are prototype model, they go to the RPMs and they kind of would like something big.
Right.
You know, I don't need a basement filling empire. I want a switching layout that I can do by myself or with a buddy, and you know.
Yeah, you'd be crazy viable. To put an addition on your house to expand your layout. I agree.
I didn't say that. No comment. But you know, realistically, I talked to Randy and I said, you know, I have to make it the way that I would have to approach it is I have to make it so that it's also three rail. So you want to be able to do three rail, two rail, and Proto 48. So basically, the two rail and the Proto 48, those can go hand in hand. If you want that option, you choose it or not. If you want to get the car done, you have to appeal to three rail modelers or people who buy three rail. I hesitate to say modelers, but people who do three rail. That's who you have to make it available to them. And the good thing about the 5344 is that bright paint schemes.
Sure.
All different road names. It's not just a black tank car.
Right. No, I think that's the IPD era. And yeah, you're right. Plenty of things to do.
Way more, the 5344, because it's not Railbox, Railbox never used them. So you have a much greater difference of road names.
And there are variants there too, because you can do double doors, you can do plug doors. Doing it right, you could do that. You could also do probably a 5544 version, which looks similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not that like with what Randy's doing with his cars. It's you have the base car, which pays for 80% of the tooling. And so Randy and I need to get together to figure out, okay, what is the tooling? What is a ballpark of what it will cost? Don't need to know an exact number. You know, what does the factory think it would cost to produce an O scale boxcar? How many are they going to require to be made? You know, I've had one person in the O scale community say, why is 2,000 a big number? Okay. All right, I think 2,000 is a lot of cars to try to sell, but in Oakscale, not major, but in Oakscale.
There's only one way to find out. You know, if you're floated and you get 40 orders, you realize, well, that may be an indication of either what I picked or the actual market interest. On the other hand,
right,
it could surprise you.
And that's the thing about this method, is you're able to test the market mm-hmm. without actually having to shell out gobs of dough.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, I'll just put up $250,000 of my money and see how many people buy 50 of the 2,000.
Yep.
And it's like,
no, I like the concept. It makes a lot mm-hmm. of sense to me, and something tells me that we'll be talking more about this in the future. I want to thank you guys for
because
your...
Maybe, think about this. Think about this, Mike. Popsicle stick side boxcars.
Yeah.
Guys, so, thanks for being on the show yep. tonight, guys.
And, you're welcome.
I hope that you have a heck of a Springfield event this weekend, and do feel free to keep us updated on the podcast group as well. Randy
Absolutely.
Hamill from prototypejunction.com and Jim Lincoln of Proto 48 fame. Thanks, guys.
That would be Lincoln Proto 48 engineering.com.
Hey, you slipped it in. Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Take care, guys.
Thank you, Mike. Yep.
Bye.
Bye.